This week on the NOLA.com WWNO Pop Culture Podcast, we're talking all things Southern food with two of our city's favorite food experts, Judy Walker, Times-Picayune NOLA.com food editor, and Brett Anderson, master of the beans, fresh back from a little vacation as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University.
And hey, I'm Allison Fensterstock. I'm a music writer at NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune, and a podcast entrepreneur. Along with Jason.
So Judy and Brett, welcome to the Pop Culture Podcast.
Thank you. It's really fun to be here.
I'll second that. Thanks for having us.
So Judy, let's start with you. You have an ongoing web video series on NOLA.com right now called In Judy's Kitchen. And you recently began working with the theme of Southern food and how to cook it. When you went through your recipe archives, how did you choose what made the cut?
We decided to do the Southern theme because when we were looking at New Orleans recipes, we kept having a long, we had a long, long list of all these dishes we considered iconic. We did 24 of them. But then we had all these dishes that people think of now as New Orleans dishes, but they didn't really originate here. Shrimp and grits is something that people now think of as from New Orleans, but it really came out of Charleston, South Carolina. So when we really looked at the list, at all our ideas, there were several things like that, like fried green tomatoes with shrimp remoulade, for instance. That fried green tomatoes is more of a Southern thing, and Joanne Clevenger just had the bright idea to put the shrimp remoulade on top of it. So that's where the idea to pursue Southern cooking came from.
So how do you define Southern cooking as distinct from Louisiana cooking or New Orleans cooking?
Well, I think as we're going to talk about today, I think it's more about the food that's made in the home, its traditions, it's, I don't know, there's a certain list of ingredients that you could go down and say things made in these states with these ingredients are liable to be this, but when you dig into it a little deeper, you find there are certain things that come out of each city, each region, each state. Like peach cobbler in Georgia, you know. Cobbler in general is considered a Southern thing, which I didn't really realize, but it is.
What is cobbler exactly? Because my girlfriend just made a cobbler, and how is that distinct from just a pie?
Oh, a cobbler is more cobbled together, okay, with the quotation marks. It's more like, it doesn't have a crust, a rolled out crust as much as a cobbler does. It's not as organized, and you can have a topping of any kind. The one we did on our In Judy's Kitchen series that went up, it has a biscuit topping, biscuits with cornmeal in it, and they are to die for. So it kind of has a crust that's just kind of poured on there on the top. No bottom crust at all. And the fresh fruit. They're almost always fresh fruit.
Oh, wow.
Isn't there a cocktail called a cobbler also?
Yeah, that's different.
And they're not the same at all?
No.
Okay.
No. I think
no crust.
But there
much
is
less
fresh
butter.
Fruit. There is fruit.
Can I add something about
the definition of Southern cuisine?
He's a good thinker, not
well,
me.
I just think as a it's a very it's a topic we could sit here all day and talk about just the definition of it. And as a Yankee born Southerner, it took me a long time to realize that it sort of depends on what your perspective is, what Southern cuisine is. And I know a lot of sort of writers and authors over the years that I've read and cooked from their books to try to get a sense of Southern cuisine have different answers to that question too. Edna Lewis is a very well-known cookbook author. She's passed in the last several years, but she was, you know, Southern food for her was from Virginia. Bill Neal, who's a little bit of a fringier figure but an important Southern chef, you know, started Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and his perspective really is from North Carolina. Craig Claiborne, who's a hugely influential person on how Americans eat and the way they think about food, wrote for the New York Times but was from Mississippi and wrote an influential book about Southern food. And if you look at all of those texts next to each other, you're going to see a slightly different definition, but with a lot of the same dishes. You know, you're going to see fried chicken is going to be a constant. Biscuits tend to be a constant. You know, fruit pies tend to be a constant. And but I, you know, just to get a little bit more at that, I do think it depends on who you ask. And of course, if you ask a New Orleanian, a lot of times, you know, it's like, who the hell is Southern food? We've got Creole, we've got Cajun, we've got New Orleans food, and it exists in its own sort of universe.
I think it's interesting that, Judy, you did grow up in the South, and Brett, you didn't. So my guess is that your sense of Southern food came out of home kitchens, and yours might have initially come out of restaurants? Like, how did you both start to get a sense of what Southern food was?
To me, it was just the food I ate every day. We didn't call it Southern food, you know. But I grew up on beans and cornbread. You know, pinto beans was what we cooked, not red beans. This was in Arkansas and Oklahoma. And a lot of fried food. Mama always had the grease, the bacon grease, you know, in a jar on the stove to cook with. Fried okra. Lots of stuff fresh from the garden. Southerners have always been real dependent on fresh, fresh, wonderful produce. All this farm-to-table stuff right now, people have been doing that in the South for 150 years already, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the Southern food I think of is really the food of necessity. It's food for poor people.
Well, it is and it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's when poor people are cooking, it is food for poor people. I think it is true what you say to some degree about the economics, the socioeconomics of Southern food. My first taste of what I thought was Southern food, I grew up in Minneapolis in the up near Canada, was really soul food. You know,
right.
I mean, restaurants, right. African-American-owned restaurants. You know, there was a great migration that ended up a lot in Chicago, and you had people that ended up in Minneapolis and Des Moines, Iowa, and too, some African-Americans. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of shared dishes there, collard greens, fried chicken we already mentioned. And that was really my first taste of it, and that was in restaurants. And then as a restaurant critic, I mean, moving to the South, first to Washington, D.C., and then New Orleans, it was almost entirely through restaurants that I formed my own definition for what it tastes like.
Well, and I've always been struck by, because of the truth of this, Julia Reed, who's from here in New Orleans, when she writes her books, she always writes about the fact that they had to cook and entertain in their homes because there were no restaurants growing up in Mississippi.
Yeah, in the Delta, yeah.
In the Delta. And so that's true. There was no restaurant culture in a lot of the rural South, period. So it did grow out of home cooking, and these people like Bill Neal and Edmund Lewis did elevate it and serve it. And so it has sort of gone that route. But to me, it's very based on home cooking.
And sort of high-end Southern restaurants, you know, restaurants showcasing Southern cuisine, there's a profusion of them now. But I don't get the sense that that was always the case. You know, I mean, it's not that there wasn't high-end restaurants in New Orleans and Atlanta and what have you. Mm-hmm. But the degree to which it's been Southern food is accepted as something that a chef of a serious ambition will go after is kind of our generation's expression, I think.
Definitely. And it's become a huge trend. This is another thing we here in New Orleans don't really talk about. But I am getting, for the past 4 years maybe, I have gotten a cookbook in the mail that's a variation of something about Southern food for the past 4 years, one after another. There's nothing hotter right now. Aren't there like restaurants in New York, Brett, that this is like the
absolutely
thing?
I mean, in New York, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, just to name some places I might have been in the last couple of years, you know, all have some young chef or established chef, that as it might be, who is open a restaurant that is identified as Southern cuisine or is inspired by Southern cuisine in some way, inspired by the South.
Mm-hmm.
And fried chicken, of course, has been enjoying its moment in the sun for about a decade, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. When did John T. Edge write that book on fried chicken?
I don't remember exactly, but I'm going to say 2004.
And that was 10 years ago. I really think it was.
Guys, I think we're going to have to put a bibliography at the end of this because you guys are throwing out so many names, and I think people are going to want to read up on this. But with the restaurant thing, how have you seen it translate? Like onto a restaurant plate, the Southern ingredients. Like, what are some trends you've seen? Or
well, the deviled eggs, we documented that. Documented that.
Our colleague Todd Price has documented the deviled egg craze. You know, I think the and Judy can weigh in on this, obviously, but something that leaps to my head right away is the side dishes available, the vegetable side dishes. The most popular restaurant that I can think of that does this is Koshan, which identifies as, you know, I think it's a fascinating place. I like the restaurant very much, but I think it's intellectually interesting about how they kind of reframed Cajun cuisine in a city that you would have thought you couldn't do that. But also it self-identifies as Southern.
Right.
As Cajun and Southern, and they do a lot of you know, the stewed okras and the
beans,
and the stuffed vegetables
bean
and beans and legumes as green side dishes, and you see that more often these days than you did when I first moved to New Orleans, which is in 2000. You did not see that as an option as many restaurants. I'd say that you see that actually in restaurants outside of New Orleans too. more frequently than you used
threes.
To.
Yeah. The threes.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something else that New Orleans chefs are doing right now, and chefs across this country are doing, is pickles. Mm-hmm. Home pickles. Yeah. Think about this. Pickling and canning and preserving has always been, in not just the South, but especially in the South, it's always been a huge tradition that people would make these huge quantities and put it up. I mean, they had to do this out of necessity. They would put up their produce from their garden every year. And I was at the Louisiana Restaurant Association show yesterday, and one of the produce purveyors identified that as a trend. All the chefs are now ordering Kirby pickles from her and making their own pickles. And just, she said, order after order. I did a story about 5 or 6 years ago on this when it was Commander's, Dante's Kitchen, all these places were making their own pickles. Cochon has always done that. But now everybody is making their own pickles.
And that is an interesting Southern, I think an important distinction about Southern food. As a Yankee, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't realize until I got older that a pickle could be something other than a cucumber.
Pickled peaches!
Yeah. All these different pickled fruits and vegetables and stuff I feel like is a Southern impulse more than it is
peaches.
In other places.
Pickled peaches.
I had pickled peaches on Sunday night at G.W. Finn's in the French Quarter. They were serving it with a dish of raw seafood. I forget. I think it was cobia. They were doing pickled peaches.
See, and we would get those out at Christmas. Those were like a holiday thing because they were so special.
So does this tradition come from, I mean, because there was such an abundant yield from Southern gardens every season or because there wasn't refrigeration or?
Both. And you had a storm cellar, you know, to get away from the tornadoes, and you would store it down there.
It's interesting that you mentioned Cochon. And it kind of ties into the different types of Southern food. Donald Lake opened up a Cochon in Lafayette. And it closed. From what I hear anecdotally, Cajuns didn't like Donald Link's approximation of what Cajun food was. And selling it back to them, especially at an inflated price. Or let me not say that.
No, I mean, I think there are issues of class surrounding the food that we think of as Southern food, which I don't know how heavily we want to unpack those in this podcast, but...
I think Cajun or Cochon opening in Lafayette was, to me as a journalist, a very interesting event. And we covered it as it opened. And Donald and his partners talked quite openly about how they thought that the opportunity in – they thought there was an opportunity in Cajun country not because of what they saw in other Cajun restaurants, because of what they saw in other sort of high-end restaurants. They saw sushi restaurants that were really busy. They saw chain seafood restaurants that were really busy. And they thought, well, why don't we open a fancy Cajun place that can attract that crowd? And they discovered they're better answering this question than I am, but I know from reporting that story and sort of having some conversations with the people involved since then that the public in Lafayette, for whatever reason, didn't buy into the idea that that food was worth it in that kind of setting. You know, food that they were used to eating at home that sort of was born of subsistence living. And I think Cajun country in the Lafayette area is still pretty unique in that sense, that they still do really view that part of their culture as something that is still tied to the land and the home, and they're a little bit more suspicious of it when it ends up in restaurants.
Yeah, I was just at a boucherie a couple of months ago, and, you know, everybody has an understanding of what they need to do and how do they need to prepare and how they need to help. So I think it just speaks exactly to what you're saying, that, you know, there's still this intimate connection to the production of food that I think people in larger cities have been removed from.
I think you're right.
And I think, you know, home gardening has been a huge trend for the past several years as well. There is no bigger thing right now in restaurants or food than this whole farm-to-table thing. And that is exactly Southern.
And do you sense that more home cooks are becoming enthusiastic gardeners now, too, than when you first started on the
beat? I know that
beat?
For a fact. Yeah. Yes, for a fact. I mean, it's a lot of work, but it's also so rewarding. Plus, people grow into it. Typically, people age into gardening. It's not something that young people do, but it's something that people buy a house, they have land, they have a backyard, they can do whatever. But that's always been true. When you talk about class and subsistence living, if you have a nice garden in your backyard, you can eat as well as your neighbors that have got money that are having to go out and eat at a fast food place. You know, you can eat better than your neighbors if you're willing to put in the work and raise that garden.
Do you think they should stop serving every drink everywhere in mason jars? Because I'm kind of happened.
Yes. Yes, Allison. Yes. I am tired of that trend.
Think how happy the mason jar people are.
Right. Yeah. The mason jar people are thrilled. I get press releases from Ball. And
I wish I had bought stock in Ball jars like 10 years ago.
Garden Foods is the name of their corporation. It is unbelievable what their growth has done. Unbelievable. And people, then they've also expanded like the sizes of jars that you can can in. I think specifically because of restaurants canning. Mm-hmm. You know, restaurants got more room to store gallon jars of their tomatoes that they either grew or had somebody grow or.
And they'll need more if they're going to actually make use of it.
And they need more to actually make use of it, yeah. So they have expanded the jar sizes. Other companies are getting into it. My canning story this year, I mentioned an Italian company that is getting into the American market big time because they've made canning jars in Italy for a million years.
Oh, so Brett, you you edited the 2012 edition of Best Southern Food Writing, and I remember reading it and thinking your selections were really diverse. There was some environmental reporting about, I think, fishing and shrimping, and there were also some historical pieces. And I mean, all in all, it was a really well-rounded collection. So I guess, what were you thinking of when you were trying to put together something that would be a comprehensive book about Southern food?
Well, I wanted it to contain, a diversity like you mentioned in terms of topic and also in terms of journalism and nonfiction writing. I wanted there to be sort of deep reportage. I wanted there to be memoir, essay writing, review writing, these kinds of things, because there's a lot of good examples of all that out there. I also, wanted it to reflect the South as I see it, which is a little bit harder to define South than it was 20 years ago in terms of the ethnic makeup, I mean, just in terms of the broad demographics. And I don't think it's necessary anywhere in the country anymore to run just a chandelier restaurant to get your name in the paper, to stake your claim to being a creative person in this particular endeavor. And I think this is particularly true in the South, where, sort of dining lower on the hog has always been something that has been universally accepted to be a way to access pleasure and not, something that you did just when you were slumming, mm-hmm. so to speak, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So those are the types of things I think about when I think about the South and when I was putting together that particular collection, which is called Cornbread Nation. It's part of a series called Cornbread Nation, and it's the best of Southern food writing.
Can we talk about like the ethnic diversity and how that is changing the South and the Southern food? Because I think that's really interesting. I'm thinking about Edward Lee, mm-hmm. specifically, mm-hmm. and how his these chefs are coming in.
He's in Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville. Mm-hmm, thank you. And how he has, like, his version of pickling follows kimchi, And so he has created a whole new, his version of Southern food. I just think that's fascinating. And I think there's all these different confluences of how these different groups are changed, like the Vietnamese.
I was going to mention that in New Orleans. That's the one that's sort of most obvious, particularly on the restaurant side, both with new openings and longstanding established restaurants. Mm-hmm. Vietnamese, I think you could easily argue, is our deepest ethnic cuisine that isn't normally associated with New Orleans.
Right, right. And all over, especially the Gulf South, where so many of them are shrimpers now, they have opened the bakeries where people can get the beautiful French bread. I just thought about this last week. I did a post on if you can't get certain New Orleans ingredients, what else can you use? Mm. And, of course, one of the hardest things to replace is poor boy bread. And a reader said, if you have a Vietnamese bakery in your community, try their French bread to make banh mi. And I thought, that is it.
And we see that in New Orleans. Dong
totally
Phong Bakery,
do.
That's what they use at Killer Po' Boys, mm-hmm. Which is kind mm-hmm. of, which is a great modern mm-hmm. po' boy joint. And they use it elsewhere. I mean, I've seen it in other mm-hmm. places. I believe they use it at Bourne, one of John Besh's restaurants, for their sandwiches and lunch. And McClure's Barbecue, I know, uses Dong Phong buns for their hamburgers. Maybe they use mm-hmm. it for their other sandwiches as well. But, that's really taken root in New Orleans in a big way.
These new influences to Southern culture really kind of parallel the old cultures that have kind of lent themselves to Southern cooking. Is that correct?
I think so. It's just like here in New Orleans, how people come in and there's they bring their foods, but then they adapt what's already here. So you just see that happening all over.
Yeah, I mean, it's what New Orleans cuisine is supposed to be. It's a cliche that, you know, you use gumbo as the metaphor because it draws on all these influences. But, I think it is true, I think it's true even at established New Orleans restaurants, at Commander's Palace and places like Emeralds. These guys are using drawing on influences that we don't associate with sort of the creation story of New Orleans cuisine. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You can get Mexican flavors and Latin flavors and Vietnamese Asian and Southeast
flavors.
Asian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these things that you can see at restaurants like the high-end restaurants that are established New Orleans restaurants.
Mm-hmm. And also, isn't so much of what we think of as Creole cooking, isn't there a ton of African influence there because of slave kitchens? I remember there was an essay in that edition of Cornbread Nation that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, the African influence on New Orleans cuisine alone is, again, there's another book, really. Mm-hmm. But, it comes from, gumbo is one of the best examples because it's thought to come from an African word for okra. Mm-hmm. But also for generation after generation after generation, it was African Americans that were doing most of the cooking. And even if they weren't using ingredients that, came over with their ancestors on slave ships, mm-hmm. you can't deny that they weren't having an impact on the way people ate,
And African Americans had their own gardens in mm-hmm. many cases because they had half a day off in New Orleans when they were enslaved. They could profit from that in their own way and on the plantations economy as well.
So many distinctive New Orleans things go back to the Code Noir.
Definitely.
So the latest issue of Garden and Gun is focused on Southern food.
Garden and Gun is still my favorite magazine title of all time.
Isn't it great? Yeah, they're brilliant.
It's a Southern magazine, so our listeners know, right? It's kind of an upscale Southern magazine, I suppose you could say, correct?
Yes. And they do have, hunting and shooting and other stories, but they cover a lot of other types of culture. And they just had this brilliant food issue. And I loved this essay that John T. Edge had, and he compared the South to Italy. He said, mm-hmm. did you see that? Mm-hmm. That the South is America's Italy. And I loved that because that said each little region has its own thing, has its own ingredient that it's famous for, and clings to these food traditions, and not going to give them up in a way that I think really...
Yeah, no, I mean, I really like that comparison, too, mm-hmm. and it does point to this something we talked about earlier in this conversation that, Southern cuisine kind of depends, how you define it depends on where you are.
Right.
And I think that, Italian cuisine, that's something that we have been awakened to over the last couple of decades because of traveling and because of, what chefs have been doing in Italian restaurants in America, and I think we're starting to see that as much in Southern restaurants in America,
uh-huh.
too.
Uh-huh.
And that, that new issue comes at this topic from a lot of different angles, and I think it's cool.
So one of the things that I have always enjoyed since I moved here to New Orleans is learning not just what the New Orleans specialties are, but when I go out of town to make day trips or overnight trips along, especially in the Gulf South, learning about some of these other dishes and recipes. And really, I've learned a lot of this from my readers and also from reading cookbooks, like the ruby red shrimp
mm-hmm.
from
mm-hmm.
Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
What are ruby red shrimp in Alabama?
Ruby red shrimp are these shrimp that they fish from like way down deep, mm-hmm. right, off the coast of Alabama. Am I right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and they serve them at Pesh. Mm-hmm. But before that, the only place I had them or heard of them being were in the Alabama coastal restaurants.
Yeah, I've seen them, too, at when they were in season, which I don't believe they are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Dominique's on Magazine served them as well.
Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be sweeter.
Yeah, and I think I don't doubt that. Shrimp can be hard, I think.
Yeah.
I do buy this idea that different species of shrimp harvested from different waters do have gradations in taste. But when you're not tasting them side by side, I won't claim to be like, I can close my eyes and bite into a ruby red shrimp and be like, oh my gosh, it's a ruby red shrimp. You know, with oysters, it's a little different. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, the difference in taste between Gulf oysters and you know, let's say Cape Cod oysters are actually quite obvious, I think. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, uh-huh. the ones from the Northeast are much more sort of metallic and they're saltier and they're smaller. You know, there's some pretty obvious things where it goes to that. But, I never saw ruby red shrimp show up that much in restaurant menus until the last couple of years.
Uh-huh. So I do think those things are spreading around now.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I was always interested in and I discovered was a white barbecue sauce.
Oh, yeah.
From Mississippi or Alabama. Yeah.
I never really became aware of that until a couple of years ago. Maybe four years ago.
What does it taste like? I've never had white barbecue sauce.
It's based on mayonnaise.
Yeah, it's kind of mayo-y. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you have to.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I can't say I feel it that great. We mentioned it maybe too much, but Pesh serves a white barbecue sauce
thing. Yeah.
But I prefer the vinegary stuff.
And see, that's another whole essay. You could do another whole book on just, and there have been bazillions of books on just the barbecue of the South. That's another huge, great tradition.
Our old colleague, Lola Saraguile, wrote a great book about that.
Mm-hmm. Barbecue's never been super big in New Orleans until recently. Now there's a multiplicity of barbecue places popping up all over.
New Orleans, Louisiana is not the barbecue South. We're not cattle ranch country, and we're not really pig farm, country. And I think that, and I think there's the sort of cultural imperialism of Creole has, I think, elbowed that out a little bit. But, you know, you can get good barbecue in New Orleans. The Joint is one of my favorite places. I think they've really established a good barbecue business there. And I think that their food is quite good. But it's still not, you know, sometimes I do get readers who email or call asking for the great barbecue in New Orleans because I think they just assume anywhere you are in the South that you're going to get good barbecue. And I said, you know, I'll tell them places I like. But, you know, I don't necessarily, if you're here for two nights and you want to have the ultimate New Orleans dining experience, I don't know if I'd put barbecue in there, you know, if only because there's so many other places in the South where that would be something you would put in there, be it in the Carolinas, particularly Texas.
Well, and Arkansas, where I grew up, that is something you can point to in that state where you can, you know, that's something they're proud of. That heritage. Yeah.
It's like when I DJ on WOZ, I get a lot of calls asking what music to go see, and I always get people that want to know where to go hear the blues.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, it's not quite that. Like, may I suggest something else?
That's a great equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned cultural imperialism. Do you feel like the, whatever you want to call it, the American monoculture is kind of edging out Southern food, even in this kind of bright time for Southern food? Or is Southern food changing to meet the larger American tastes?
Should I
rephrase that? Is there?
No, I understand what you're asking. You know, I'm going to hedge and say yes and no, and this is why I say yes and no. I think that there are more places for any American to eat authentic, quote-unquote authentic, true Southern food prepared by a chef that really cares, using fresh ingredients, who's really done his or her homework, all that sort of stuff, anywhere in the country. And there's way more places than that than there used to be. You know, I lived in Boston for a year, and there were some great places that were doing Southern food up there. That's not a remotely Southern place.
I lived in Boston for a couple of
years. Yeah, you know, I mean, there's nothing Southern about it, right? By the same token, you can say that about almost any type of food, right? Like, it's never been a better time to eat fill in the blank as an American. You know, there's never been more good restaurants in Nashville. There's never been more good restaurants in Boise. There's never been more good restaurants in Milwaukee. There's maybe never been more good restaurants in New Orleans. One of the reasons is because of the diversity of offerings. And that, I think, is something that the general public has sort of demanded. As, you know, in these last several generations, we've seen the sort of monoculture, as you call it, really diversify. And that might mean that in New Orleans, we see fewer young chefs trying to open their version of a Trois Dames and Dean place, right? So perhaps ultimately in aggregate, you have less New Orleans, quote unquote, New Orleans food out there. But as from a diner's perspective, you have a lot more choices. And I don't really, I'm not one of these people that fears that, you know, now that you can get a decent Reuben in New Orleans and that there's all these gastropubs, that all of a sudden our foodways are endangered. I don't buy that. You know, I just don't – I think people still love the way that people eat in New Orleans, and I think that there was room for more different types of places. And I would say that that would be true throughout the South. That would be my opinion, that that is true throughout the South. But, you know, I only live in one place, so take that for what it's worth.
Well, that being said, where do you see the future of Southern food going?
I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't really know, Jason. But I do agree with Brett, and you just have to realize the common denominator of everything is that everything changes. That's the mm-hmm. only constant that ever happens. So, you know, I do think that this current popularity is going to continue for a while. It has caught on like wildfire. You could also say that as there are more restaurants, there are certainly more cookbooks that people can cook this stuff at home from now. Mm-hmm. And I believe there are. I think the general public is now demanding fresher stuff, which is chefs are responding to. Mm-hmm. They're cooking it more at home. And they're generally demanding a healthier food now. You know, that is also a big trend. So that also plays into what the chefs are giving us and what you can make for yourself at home.
So we've gone over a lot of different aspects of Southern food in a very short time. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about kind of your relationship with the food of the South, not necessarily just in New Orleans, but how your tastes have evolved or how you see things going?
Being a non-Southerner, I really do appreciate that after having lived in the South for 14 years minus 1 year, I still don't feel like I have a handle on it entirely. You know, like I think that that as both a writer and just a dining enthusiast is really, it fills me with optimism because one of the things I fear most in life is boredom. And I still feel like there's so much to discover, there's so much to taste without even having to go that far from home. And that's like a pretty great feeling to have, you know? And I think that that's sort of, in some ways, a version of how people feel about New Orleans when they're very enthusiastic about it when they move here or if they decide to live here after having lived there all their life. It's like, well, no place else is as interesting. And, you know, I think in Southern food more broadly, I feel that same thing about it, you know, that there's something about the way that it was created and its history that lends itself to constant repeat investigation and to further inquiry in ways that I just don't see other food lending themselves to.
Well, Judy Walker and Brett Anderson, the resident food experts here at NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune, thank you so much for being here with us this week.
Oh, thank you. This has been a ball.
The pleasure was ours.
To see Judy's videos, get recipes, and share your thoughts on Southern food, head over to NOLA.com/eat-drink. And tune in to 89.9 FM for more great food reporting from Poppy Tooker, Lynn Rosetta Casper, and the newest addition to our Sunday schedule, America's Test Kitchen. The Pop Culture Podcast is a co-production of the fine folks at NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune, and 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. Until next time, I'm Jason Saul.
And I'm Allison Fensterstock.